Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in tune, but the sun is a glitch but a moon.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Mr. Ben, and hi, everyone.
As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032, and you can catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Let's get straight into it, John, and what to see in the night sky now that we have, well, I was going to say less of a night sky, but we'll talk about the grand stretch in the evenings in a moment.
Here we go, indeed, yes, and there is a noticeable difference too. Now, International Space Station, March the 11th to March the 28th, so it won't be available in our evening skies, but you will get to see it in some of the morning passes as well, so just put that to date in your diary. What day is today? 24th. Uranus is 4.6 degrees lower left of a 44% lit moon, so that if you're going out spotting or trying to spot Uranus, that is a good place to look. Is the moon, and it's just to the lower left of it as well. So, Mercury. Now, these are all sneaking back into our skies at the moment, and much brighter. Venus pass each other quite low in the western twilight this particular week. Venus is magnitude minus 3.9, which is getting very bright, and it's the lower of the two, and it gets the slightest trace higher in the sunset after glow each day. Mercury much fainter, of course, and fading fast. And you'll get to see them pass each other as well, so you can always Google that one. Saturn plus 1.0 is quite hard to see. It's quite dim. And magnitude 1 against, where are we with the others? Minus 0.2 with Mercury. So pretty dim, but they are all creeping back into our skies just at the moment. Mars, unfortunately, remains completely out of sight, deeper into the glare of the sun. Jupiter, it's easy and obvious, and it glares at magnitude minus 2.5. Very easy to see. Saw it last night in a pretty clear sky. And it's nearly overhead towards the south in the early evening, which is great to see. So it's the one that's brightest to the right, just of Castor and Pollux. That's the Gemini twins. And very easy to see. You can see it week by week creeping up into the sky, where it was a few months ago, it was quite low and lower, much, much lower than the Castor and Pollux. Uranus, again, we just pointed out that it will be available pretty close to the moon if you're going out with a good telescope. Magnitude plus 5.7, that's its problem. Very, very difficult to see. It's high in the southeast these evenings at the high-power telescopes. It's a tiny but non-stellar dot, 3.6 arc seconds wide, so that's not wide at all. And you'll need a detailed finder chart to identify it amongst the similar-looking faint stars. You've got to go hunting and stay there for a little while until you actually find it. Neptune, the last one there, 7.9, is 1 degree from sinking Saturn. So it's pretty close. They're pretty close to each other, and basically is lost for the season. I just wanted to go to the red spot. I don't know whether you're a great red spot watcher.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I do. I must say I do like it. And this morning, it was February the 24th, 4:15 a.m. this morning, quite low. But it is going to appear at February the 25th at 7 minutes past midnight tonight at an altitude of 46 degrees above the horizon. So you get a good chance to see that. Of course, Saturn spins at about 9 hours 37 minutes. So you get to see the red spot quite often. It's a fine sight, definitely. And we have all the moons as well, and sometimes they're aligned, sometimes they're scattered, they just are all over the place. So it's worth a little watch, is the planet Jupiter.
Indeed it is. Even in a small telescope, you will notice at least two different colour bands of the atmosphere. And yeah, of course, the bigger and better the telescope and the clearer the sky, the more you will see, including, as you say, the great red spot, which is, of course, a storm that has been running, going on for 400 years at least. since Galileo first turned his telescope on it. I think he discovered it, and we've found out since then that it is a storm. That's some storm now. 400 years on the go. It's no sign of it easing off.
Abating.
No, yes, yeah, indeed.
It's about three times the size of the Earth is the great red spot, and running around in a circle at 450 miles per hour. Don't want to be there.
You don't want to go there anytime soon. Okay, John, thank you for that. We have a 54% waxing gibbous moon currently above the horizon. Very high up, actually. I noticed it this evening. The first quarter moon was earlier today, just after midday, actually. And the moon will set just about 4 o'clock tomorrow morning, and will rise again at 10 past 10 tomorrow morning, which time it'll be up to a 60% waxing gibbous phase as we head towards the full moon. I think it's a blood moon.
Blood, yes. Yep.
Blood moon.
That's it.
Which will be on Tuesday, the 3rd of March, at 11:30 in the morning. And the sun will rise tomorrow in Dublin at 7:21 a.m., a whole 16 minutes earlier than a week ago. A local or solar noon in Dublin is at 12:38 p.m. That is when the sun will be at its highest and exactly south of us. And then the sun sets 5:55 p.m. tomorrow evening, 14 minutes later than a week ago. And then various degrees of twilight until astronomical twilight ends, and nighttime officially begins at 7:51 p.m. tomorrow evening. So that means tomorrow we'll have 4 minutes and 9 seconds more daylight than today, and 29 minutes more daylight than a week ago, when there will be 10 hours and 33 minutes between sunrise and sunset. Just going back to your pointers for the planets, John, and the ISS. I know you mentioned that the ISS wasn't going to be visible in evening skies for some time yet, but if you're up at 6:25 a.m. tomorrow morning,
yes,
which I should be myself, mm-hmm. and hopefully I remember, it's a nice pass, actually, from 6:25 a.m. to 6:31 a.m. tomorrow morning. And on Thursday, just some more pointers for your planets. Venus and Mercury, which you mentioned, they're going to be less than 5 degrees apart, and Saturn is going to be to the upper left of those. And on Friday the 27th, Jupiter will be 8 degrees to the upper right of the moon, if you need a pointer for Jupiter. But it's hard to miss Jupiter now. It's the brightest thing in the night sky, apart from the moon itself. And on Saturday the 28th, we'll have Jupiter, Venus and Mercury will be fairly close together, a mere 4.5 degrees apart. And just as a little reminder, that's about the width of your fist. If you hold your stretch your arm out and clench your fist, and that's about 10 degrees or so. You kind of point your fist at the sky and say, oh, from one end of your fist to the other is about 10 degrees. So about half of that, obviously, is 5 degrees. It's a fairly rough measure, but at least it gives you an idea. So a fist width, can't even say that, half a fist width apart on Saturday the 28th will be Jupiter, Venus and Mercury.
Now, February the 19th, 1986 was the launch of the Russia's Mir space station. Just to give you one of those on this day in space, or near to this day in space. The Soviet Union launched the Mir space station. I remember this as well. Do you, Ben? I just...
I remember the Mir, but I don't remember the date of the launch. When was it? 1980,
February the 19th, 1986. And while this wasn't the first space station launched into orbit, it was the first one that was like a jigsaw and had to be assembled piece by piece. So there's a little bit of interesting information for you.
Unlike the... of course, there was previous... space stations, fairly small. The Salyut was the Russian or the Soviet one. As you mentioned, that was didn't have to be assembled. It was small. It went up in one piece of kit, as was the... Oh, before that. Was that before the American... what was it called? The first space station, the one that crashed into Australia. Oh, do you think I can think of it now?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Tongue twisters. Yes, we'll have to Google that. We get somebody to tell us on the text line or something.
Please do. 087-179-1032. Remind me, what was the Skylab? Thank you.
Here.
Yes.
Funny, we only mentioned it in the last couple of weeks as well.
I'm not sure whether Salyut was before Skylab or not. I think Skylab was first.
Somebody can help us on the text line there just to see. Now, we've been waiting in anticipation for the Artemis 2 rocket to launch again. It's missed its January, it's missed its February, and it looks now this stage is going to miss its moonshot in March as well. There has been a number of problems. We were just talking about this before we came on air. LA liquid hydrogen was the first problem that they had, a bit of a leak.
At the first wet dress rehearsal?
Yeah, and then we have now a problem with the helium. And it's been a problem so much that they've actually stopped and started to bring the rocket back into its little kennel, if we want to call it a kennel.
Vehicle Assembly Building,
And this is just a few weeks from launching four astronauts on the historic lunar flight. Today it's facing the month-going delay or more. So it's not looking particularly good for a March.
No, I think it's completely out of the question now. They want to bring it back in. It's a four-mile journey from the launch pad to the vehicle assembly building. And because it's so big and heavy, it travels about 1 mile, an hour on the crawler, so it'll take about 4 hours, and they hope to do that today was the plan, to identify the helium flow, and also they need to bring it back in to gain better access to it. They can get up close and personal to it rather than working on the launch pad itself. And also, I think the weather forecast wasn't too good, so. Which means now the four-person Artemis 2 crew were released again from the launch quarantine, and they will remain in Houston while the work proceeds in Florida. And, of course, lots of tests and things to do, and NASA will hold a media event in the coming day or two to update us on what's happening. But as we mentioned a few weeks ago, actually, that April was more likely to be launched in April than March or February or March. So we'll keep you updated on that.
I just have to wait and see, of course, NASA Chief Jared Isaacman. And he is a guy that I watched going up into space on one of the private spacecrafts. And he went up over the space station, stayed there for, was it 3 days? Opened the door, stuck their heads out just to have a look to see what was going on, then back in and came back down again and had a bit of a ball at the same time. But he's in charge now of the NASA network. His name is Jared Isaacman. He's quite a name for, I suppose, rockets launching and things like that. And he's loads of money as well, so he's helping with all that sort of stuff. So keep an eye out for his name, and let's hope that he makes a decision to make a ruling for an April launch.
I'm sure he will. He is the guy who recently was giving Boeing and Starliner a bit of a roasting over the stranded astronauts. You may remember that the two astronauts, Butch Wilmore, Suni Williams, they went up to the International Space Station on the Boeing Starliner test flight. It was the first crewed flight of it, and had a bit of a problem with it, and they were supposed to stay there for 8 to 14 days, but it turned into a 9-month mission, and because they didn't want to, they thought it was too risky to bring them back in the Starliner, so the next craft that went up was supposed to take up 4 people, but it just took up 2, so that those two guys, or one guy and one gal, of course, could go back. Now, he did say that, what did he say? He said the Starliner has design and engineering deficiencies that must be corrected, but the most troubling failure revealed by this investigation is not hardware, it's decision-making and leadership. And he said, if left unchecked, that could create a culture incompatible with human spaceflight, and that the Starliner is less reliable for crew survival than other crewed vehicles, and that NASA will not fly another Starliner, or at least another crew on Starliner, until technical issues are understood and corrected, and a problematic propulsion system is fixed. Boeing, in return, they said, well, we've made substantial progress on corrective actions and technical challenges that we've encountered and such like. But Jared Isaacman, he didn't put all the blame on Boeing. He did say that some of it was NASA's fault. He said, we, meaning NASA, managed the contract. We accepted the vehicle. We launched the crew. We made the decision for docking, from docking through post-mission actions. So a considerable portion of the responsibility and accountability rests with NASA. And that basically, they're also saying that they failed the two astronauts who have since hung up their spacesuits.
Yeah. Ooh-wee. There you go. Now.
Yeah, a bit of a roasting there.
Yep, indeed. Now, something about the Chinese Shenzhou 20 mission. I'm not sure whether a lot of you would know about this. On April the 25th, four Chinese taikonauts were launched to their space station, and they were doing their stuff. They were due to come back on November the 5th, but unfortunately, a day before they were due to come back, one of them spotted a crack in the window of their spacecraft to come back, and they had to delay that a little bit. In fact, they had to delay it so much, they had to send up a second Shenzhou 21 mission with three taikonauts in it to swap places and let the first lot come back down again. Then they had to send up another spacecraft, an empty one this time, and it was full of food and provisions and everything else, so that the gang that went up the second time could go back down again, so they had a spare craft. But eventually, what they did was they left the spacecraft empty, de-docked, if that's the correct word.
De-docked. Yes, it sounds like the Dublin doctor on emergency call. De-docked.
So they let it come back to Earth on its own, a little bit of damage inside, but not too much. But seemingly the crack was big enough. And the reason for the crack was it was hit by a piece of space junk. And it's lucky they noticed it, just in case there could have been an implosion or an explosion probably of the window and that coming back down. So, yep, everything went A-OK. The trouble was it was very, very cold weather on the way down, and it was way in the middle of nowhere. It was freezing. The guy who was supposed to be in the spacecraft to operate the parachute couldn't. So it sort of came down pretty hard. And it wasn't damaged too much, but they got it back again as well. So they had to rush somebody out to cut the parachute because it was quite windy that day and it was starting to pull the spacecraft along the ground as well. So it was a sort of a doomed spacecraft. So everything went tickety-boo in the end and all was A-OK. So that's an interesting story. You can catch that. I only caught this earlier on today and when it was released into the media, I suppose, and us. And it is well worth checking to see if there's anything wrong with the spacecrafts at any point that are due to return. So hopefully it won't happen again. But the growing concern about space junk really is the problem. That's,
indeed, and there's only going to be more and more of it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, John, for that. And thank you to Aaron for your text educating me. Remember, we were talking about the space stations, which one came first. Anyway, Aaron says, Salyut, Almaz, and Cosmos were launched before Skylab. There you are.
That answers the question.
I would have, if I was betting, I would have, because I remember Skylab was the early 70s, somewhere 72, 73, 74. I know I had three crews. But thank you for that, Aaron, much appreciated. Aaron is, I think he resides in Tala, does he? Or, not sure. Anyway, thank you, Aaron, wherever you are.
Great to have you still listening. We don't often hear on the text lines whether people are listening, but we know that you are. This is
We know.
We get this feeling, yeah.
Yeah, much appreciated indeed. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and Ben Emmett, and our text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can contact us on astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. That's our email. And also, you can get us live on the web, of course, dublincityfm.ie, and also as a podcast. John.
Yeah, SpaceX landed its Falcon 9 rocket in the Bahamas for the first time, or the second time ever. That's a nice place to land, nice and warm. And it landed a rocket in the Bahamas for the second time, Thursday, 19th of February, and everything went according to plan there. And it was launched, and then 8 minutes later it came back down again. This is a fantastic and a fascinating thing to watch. One of these landing catcher type things as well. So, and Elon Musk wants to put a satellite catapult on the moon. It's not a new idea. It's been thought about before as well. There was a guy called Gerard O'Neill. He proposed something similar back in 1974. Now, I didn't know about that, I must say. But last week, the space founder, of course, Elon Musk, advised workers at the newly acquired company that he wanted to set up a factory on the moon to build artificial intelligence, that's AI satellites, and he called for a colossal catapult on the lunar surface to fling them back out into space in a sort of cost-saving, low-energy way to generate and get people back up into space again to come home. So he reinforced that belief on February the 11th in an all-hands meeting with the XAI staff, is what he calls it, which was on video, of which the company posted on X, and Musk said that while launching AI satellites from Earth is an immediate focus, SpaceX's new Starship mega rocket also will enable operations on other worlds. And if they build this catapult, it's an easy way of launching them back into space, especially if they're on the moon.
You get a momentum by, in a centrifuge, and then like a slingshot, like the catapult.
Yeah,
it's, and then one end go and. Yeah.
The technology behind it is...
I presume it's for unmanned, though, because that would be...
Well, I don't know. It's an electromagnetic mass driver launching the payload from the surface of the moon. So, who wants to be in that first?
Not me, yeah. No. Well, I suppose... Well, of course, it takes less energy to get into orbit around the moon than the Earth. You have no resistance... Well, the gravity is only 1/6 of the force of Earth's. And of course, because there's no atmosphere, there's less resistance there too. And that actually reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever seen that film, one of those really, really awful, one of the first films back in the 1920s, black and white, silent ones. I think it was called The Man in the Moon. And it was, again, when people 150 years ago looked at the moon and thought, exactly what is it and where it is and how far away is and how could we get there? One of the early ideas, of course, went after gunpowder was invented or known about. Well, that was known a couple of hundred years at that stage. But that if you could basically, like a gun, fling somebody out, shoot them to the moon, if you know what I mean, like in a capsule that you could... Put the cannonball behind them, inside the cannonball.
Yeah.
But of course, they knew there wasn't a start. You nearly have to get up a great amount of speed because you knew how much force you put into, say, a cannonball or a bullet, the further it would go, the greater the speed. But of course, to get to the moon, the initial force would be so high and the acceleration, the gravitation, but the number of G's would just kill you instantly.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's an aside.
The reason for the catapults are to possibly put 500 to 1,000 terawatts per year of AI satellites into deep space. That's one of the main reasons. So, yeah, you're not putting humans or anything with any life and into a meaningly ascend into the Kardashev scale and harness its non-trivial percentage of the sun's power. So... It's an interesting concept, yep, and you get an awful lot of more satellites in a little bit further out than we're getting satellites in low Earth orbit as well, so the junk would be just sneaking out a little bit further.
Thank you, John. Now, I remember my mother, Lord rest her, now 40 years ago, she'd be saying, about the weather. No, it's all them rockets they're sending up. Well, maybe she's not wrong, actually, because I don't know whether you remember when part of a SpaceX rocket re-entered the Earth's atmosphere exactly a year ago, it was, that it created a spectacular fireball that streaked across European skies. Actually, it landed west of Ireland, I believe. But there was a German team, and they managed to measure the pollution the rocket's upper stage emitted in the difficult-to-study upper atmosphere. This was the first time that somebody has managed to do that, and they say it's vital to learn more about this little-understood form of pollution because of the huge number of satellites that are planned to be launched in the coming years. You may recall that Mr. Musk, he's planning to launch a million, isn't he? And China planning to launch around 200,000. But it was, that upper stage of a Falcon 9. And it was seen from the UK to Poland. So they wanted to measure how the rocket polluted what they called the ignorosphere. That's in a mixture of ignorance and sphere. It's a part of the atmosphere that's very difficult to study. It's the region between 50 and 100 kilometers above Earth. So it includes the mesosphere and part of the lower thermosphere. Well, they used LIDAR, which measures pollution in the atmosphere. Basically, what you do is you shoot out lots of laser pulses into the atmosphere and see what bounces back. Anyway, they detected a spike in the metal lithium about 100 kilometers up from the Earth. And they said this plume had 10 times more lithium than is normal in that part of the atmosphere. And they said that 1 ton of that type of emission at 75 kilometers altitude is equivalent to 100,000 tons at the surface. I don't know how that equates or what the exact problem with lithium. Well, certainly it's not good to have lithium in the atmosphere. But apparently there are around 14,000 active satellites orbiting the planet. Of course, there's a lot of defunct ones and bits and pieces, as you mentioned, also, John, space junk in particular.
Yeah, I love space junk. Well, we don't really like space junk, but it's a fascinating topic. Now, just before we go, why don't more Tatooine, or whatever way you want to pronounce it, like exoplanets exist in our Milky Way galaxy? This is a binary star system where you'd have two suns and planets and all this, and of the 3,000 known binary star systems in our galaxy, more than 6,000 exoplanets in the Milky Way have also been discovered, and just 14 have been confirmed with these twin star things coming around as well. It's not like us with just the one star that we have, and the moon and a few planets here and there and everywhere, but it's really confusing researchers and scientists at the moment as to why there are not more, I suppose, suns rolling around different planets, or should I say the planets going around and not being so close to each other as well. So it's just one of these things that you just get their heads around at the moment. So it's all to do with planetary alignment and all this type of stuff. So there you are. So
thank you, John, for that. I think we've run out of time, and I did want to talk about the alien signals coming to Earth, but we haven't seen them, or maybe they have. But basically, it's about needing more, and if we had more sensitive equipment, that maybe we will someday in the future detect them. That's, of course, if they are out there. And maybe we've just missed some of the signals. But that's for another day. That's all the time I say we have for. Don't forget our email address again is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And thanks to John for his news items. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. It's music all the way now until 2 a.m. because up next we have Dublin's Greatest Hits, followed by 10 p.m. to midnight. Nigel Wood has his ear to the globe with his world music mix. And then from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul in a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time. 7:30 p.m. next week, we'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.